Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, badly evening to you.
Badly evening. It's been a while, the familiar cold embrace of the badly evening.
Yeah, badly evening, morning, afternoon, whatever it might be. We are recording about an hour after the final whistle, so normally when we record, it's usually at the earliest, it's sort of like the next day. It's very rare that we do one of these straight after the game. So
with good reason, usually.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. You can get to see things again. You know, the cold light of day is a good place to, you know, make your mind up about certain things. So I just want to get it straight here on the record that if I'm a little more erratic than I normally might be, if I feel a little bit more, I don't know, reactive, or what word can I use here? Fuming.
Explosive.
explosive. It's going to be an explosive. If it's that, it is because I'm still feeling the heat of the game, the heat of the performance, the result, and I just fucking hate them.
Here we go.
There we go.
Straight in.
Straight in. Why is Scott McTominay a footballer? He is a farmhand who leads cows and cattle to a field, and he can break rocks with his bare hands, and he's very useful about the place. He can probably mend machinery and things like that. And I don't know, when he gets a few pints on him, he does tricks like loafing a tree, you know? Why? I just can't.
I saw somebody on Twitter say that we actually bore witness to quite a football milestone today. Scott McTominay's first ever yellow card.
was that when he like picked up Gabriel Jesus and slammed him to the ground like he was in fucking WWE or something? Was that one?
I think it may well have been.
I'm getting wound up already.
I hate them as well. I really, really hate Man U. I think they're second only to Spurs for me. In terms of my intense dislike, disdain even.
Oh, yes, hatred is a word I would use.
Yeah, so it's a horrible one.
Mm.
And quite a familiar one in some ways. I feel like we've told this story before that we're about to tell for the next 90 minutes.
Yeah, you know what, though? I have to say, you know, there have been times when we've gone to Manchester United and we've got caught on the counter and been sucker punched and things like that. Like you say, it's a familiar story. It's been read to us by our grandfathers down the years. Let me tell you a scary tale, young man, before you go to sleep. And then you have the horrible dreams of
once upon a time, there was a team who had 48 touches in the box, but only 3 shots on target.
I was going to get to that. But, you know, I have to say, for all of that, and for all of how familiar it is, I don't really remember a game where we went there and looked so good and so dominant. And we are obviously going to talk about not making the most of our possession, of our territory, of our chances, all of that kind of stuff. But I really did think we played fantastically well for about, what, first 15 minutes or so was Manchester United. They seemed to be on top. But after that, until basically their second goal, I thought we were really, really good. And by any standards of the phrase, against the run of play is appropriate to the second Manchester United goal, and probably in some ways the first one too.
Yeah, I think that's true. The game changed on the disallowed Martinelli goal, didn't it? Arsenal really got footing from that point on. I thought it was really interesting that I was reading Marcus Rashford's quotes after the game, and bear in mind, this is a match that his team have just won 3-1.
Mm.
And he said, I thought it was an even game. I think that's quite a big sort of tacit admission, really. You know, if a player's just won a match but theoretically by a comfortable scoreline is calling it even. I think there's an admission in there that basically Arsenal were better for long periods. And I feel the same as you. I actually was encouraged by quite a lot in the performance. And if Arsenal play like that regularly, they will win a lot more games than they will lose.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll win 5 in 6, apparently, roughly.
I think I said to you at halftime, like, if we can just keep playing like this, there's a goal there, a goal will come, and we'd early chances in the second period, and then we got the goal. And, you know, I felt, you know, there are some times where you think, you look at your team playing and you go, I don't know where a goal is coming from. I don't know how we're going to get a goal. We're not really threatening them. And look, the great thing about football is, and one of the bad things about football as well, is that like a goal can come in an instant, in a heartbeat, in a second, against the run of play, with the run of play, all of it. And I think we saw some of that with Manchester United. But, you know, it was really good stuff from Arsenal, you know, until, of course, you get to that... that final bit of, you know, putting the ball in the back of the net and everything else, which I'm sure we will come to. But overall, the sort of composure we showed, the way we played, the way we played the game in their half, like you say, 47 or 48 touches in the opposition box. I was sort of passing through when they were talking about that on Sky because I just could not look at Roy Keane and Gary Neville a second longer. So I went into the kitchen, made myself a drink to bring up here to do the podcast. But did they say that was some kind of record?
I didn't see that.
Right.
I just saw Adrian Clarke put out a tweet, lots of pressure but not enough punch from Arsenal. 48 touches in the box, 3 shots on target. United had 17 touches in the box and 6 shots on target. So
yeah,
the efficiency within that 18-yard box is one of the areas where they edged us, certainly. But, you know, everything up to that point was pretty good. I thought Arsenal had the better of possession, the better of territory. Use of the ball was generally better. Build-up was better. We just, you know, we lost it on pretty fine margins, and mistakes were made at the back, certainly.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, in this league, you will have games where you dominate and get sucker punched, especially against a team with the counter-attacking quality of Manchester United. And unfortunately, that's what this was, really, for Arsenal.
Yeah.
And played, I thought, like the home team for a long period.
No, I agree. We were on top and it was great. And I thought the quality of the football, you know, again, until that final bit was really, really good. But I think, you know, we have to remember, like, a lot of the discussion, a lot of the talk about this team is how it is a young team, how it's still developing, how it's still maturing. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe you could see today there the elements of maybe immaturity is maybe the wrong word, but in a couple of the goals in particular, we weren't quite aware of the danger, weren't quite aware of the threat. And I think maybe with a bit more experience, you know, you look to cut off those opportunities for Manchester United. You know,
yeah, and I think as well, I'm sure we'll get to it, but maybe the big tactical change and the triple sub in the second half, you know, Arsenal had played their way back into the game when 1-0 down, and I think perhaps it's easy to say with hindsight, but it may have been more prudent to kind of pursue that slightly more conservatively rather than going all out as we did with the threat they offered in behind.
Yeah, well, we'll come to the substitutions because I do think that is a talking point for sure. And Mikel Arteta, I watched his post-match interview and, you know, he didn't seem to think that was really the issue, but I'm not sure I agree. So yeah, we'll come to that. So look, United started relatively brightly. I mean, the team, we had Zinchenko back in, we had Odegaard starting, we had Aaron Ramsdale starting, you know, after some injury worries, etc., etc. So that was nice, a decent team. Albert Sambi-Lokonga kept his place in midfield. And then the front four was the front four that we've sort of come to expect. Were you surprised maybe that it took us a while to get into the game?
Yes and no. I mean, it's Old Trafford. I think whatever shape United have been in the early period of this season, they were coming into this off the back of a couple of wins. It's a big game. United are a big Arsenal, a big rival. I think it's not unusual that you go away to a big ground in the Premier League and it might take you 10 to 15 minutes to settle into it. But I do think, as I said, that moment where Martinelli went through and, you know, we've spoken about finishing. I mean, that was maybe the finish of the game from him. That seems to bring Arsenal to life and also slightly cow United, because it just, it was a reminder of Arsenal's quality when they do get it right.
Right. So what about that particular incident then? Because, I might need to take a drink here. You know, I'm
it's been quite the weekend for the officiating and for the for use of video technology.
Let me ask you this before we get into the nuts and bolts of the thing. When Paul Tierney went over there and was standing and he was looking and he was looking and he was looking and he spent a long time looking, did you think he was going to do what Michael Oliver did yesterday when, I don't know if people saw it, but in the Nottingham Forest game, he gave a penalty, the VAR told him to go over and have a look, and everyone goes, oh, he's going to have a look, he's going to change his mind, and he went over and had a look and went, no, penalty. Which is quite refreshing, you know. I mean, there's a lot of criticism for VAR, and we will obviously have some questions about that and some discussion about that, I'm sure. But did I fool myself into thinking that maybe the same thing could happen again?
He looked at it for a very long
time. Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Long enough to suggest that whatever he was seeing was not clear or obvious. Yeah, he really did. And I guess as soon as he went over to the monitor, my hopes were low. But the longer he looked at it, the more I thought, well, if he can't definitively see that he's wrong, then maybe he'll stick with it. Especially with VAR coming under such scrutiny and such criticism in the last 24 hours, I almost wondered if, you know, the referees might have been told, well, look, you don't have to agree with it if you don't want to.
Yeah.
You're in charge. And I thought maybe there'll be a little directive and we'll benefit from it. But that was... At Old Trafford, maybe that was naive.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, they did say, I think Martin Tyler said on commentary, the referees want to give the goals. I was thinking, did you get a fucking email from PGMOL before you went on air? Because, you know, that's really not what I'm seeing and not what I've been seeing with the implementation of our...
It's joy sapping.
Yeah, exactly.
It's honestly like, how could we make this less fun?
Yeah. Let's find the best thing about football and then see if we can take it away every single time it happens. It's just...
It is kind of horrendous, yeah. It's pure party pooping. And I think I do this thing when we score. I don't know about you, but my mind starts racing. Like, in my mind, I'm already like,
was there a foul here?
Yeah, what a goal. Martinelli, what a season he's having. His star is on the rise. He's going to make the Brazil squad for the World Cup. And I sort of get carried away so much in the moment. And then... it all just gets punctured.
Yeah. I find myself more and more thinking, I go back and I think, is there...
am I allowed to celebrate this one?
Yeah. Like, was there something that I should be worried about in the build-up? And obviously that one, you know, you could see that there was a collision between the two players. But to my mind, when I saw it happening, I was like, well, you know what that is? That is the very, in inverted commas, foul, or the kind of incident that they are letting go all this season because they want to let it flow, right? So do you only...
You described it as a collision between two players. I think that's almost exactly what it was.
Yeah. So do you let it flow when there isn't a goal, but if there is a goal, you can pull it back? I have to say...
Yeah, that's very true. Like, if that move results in anything else, like it's not pulled back, you know? Did you think... trying to be objective in as far as it's possible, did you think it was a foul?
I mean, it's probably one of those where if it was the other way around, I would say, like, if it was Odegaard who was fouled by Eriksen and United went on to score, I'd probably
it's a red card offence.
Yeah, of course. And he should be put in jail for the rest of his days. But, you know, I also think that... I watched Mikel Arteta afterwards and he was asked about it and he said, well, you know, it's the consistency of like, what is a foul now? What is the foul? He said he lets them go early in the game because it's a big game. They want to create the atmosphere. They want to let them go. And there were no cards. And I think Lisandro Martinez should have been booked after about 2 minutes.
Couple of minutes, yeah.
For a foul on Gabriel Jesus. You know, that sets the tone as much as just letting it go. I mean, he gave a free kick, of course, but I still think that should have been a booking. Did you watch the Leicester-Brighton game earlier?
I saw highlights.
Right.
Saw
Did highlights. You see the Leicester goal in the first minute of the game or the very early on?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So did you see Yuri Tielemans barge? I can't remember who it was. March, I think it was. Yeah. He literally barged him in the back and pushed him off the ball, and Leicester went up the field and scored a goal. It was twice, perhaps even three times, more obviously a foul than Odegaard on Eriksen. No VAR. Didn't pull it back. Goal stands. And in this occasion, I don't really understand why, if there is this let it flow edict, the exact foul that they're being told to let it go, let it flow, whatever you want to say, is being pulled back and micro-analyzed in slow motion, where everything looks worse anyway. Everything always looks worse in slow motion.
Yeah. And also, I mean, look, we conceded a goal direct from a corner on Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Where I thought there was a much more evident foul, and the general perception appeared to be, oh, that's soft. Can't go back for that.
Yeah.
And yet this, which happens not on the goal line, but 50 yards up the pitch, we must go back for it.
Yeah.
I think in the Premier League that we've been accustomed to watching in the last few years, that is often blown as a foul. But there has been a different directive this year. And actually, I don't mind that. Like, I like a physical game and I am sort of open to that. I think it can be beneficial. So I was very frustrated to see that chalked off. And you know, the pundits go, he doesn't get the ball. But I think
you can use
whether
your
or not
body
he gets the ball and whether or not he fouls the guy are sort of different questions.
Agree.
And he's just sort of near him.
And after what we did was fucking sensational, because it was a brilliant pass from Bukayo Saka, and the run from Gabriel Martinelli, the touch, the pace, and then the finish, because that's not like where he put that ball. It's kind of, I'm not going to say it's ridiculous, but I mean, like, when De Gea is coming out, I'm thinking, is he going to go to De Gea's right? Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, it gives him maybe a bit more of the goal to aim for. But, like, to put it beyond De Gea and into the bottom right-hand corner with his wrong foot, sensational for Martinelli. And I think it's basically a crime against humanity that has been chalked off.
Yeah, and we'll get on to we had a lot of questions, haven't we, about officiating and VAR. So we're, there's more to be said on that, I think.
But yeah.
In the context of the game, it was a deflating moment, but also one that seemed to help the team. Because it was a reminder of what they're capable of. And I think they built momentum really from that point in the game.
They did. And they, you know, I'm trying to remember now, because this is where watching the game again or watching the highlights again becomes quite useful. But certainly the momentum, the trajectory of the game completely changed after that incident, because we just got right on top of them.
Yeah. And actually, you know, just before the opening goal, we had a couple of moments. One was Martinelli going down the left-hand side, deflected cross that De Gea, I thought, did well to keep out at the near post. There was Odegaard played a brilliant cross across the penalty box, and Martinelli met it with a header.
Yeah.
Which was, again, pretty well kept out.
Yeah.
And, you know, that I think was the 32nd minute that was saved. But even before the disallowed goal, Saliba had a half chance really inside the box.
Yeah, he should have done better with that for sure.
Yeah, and then, a couple minutes after we had that little flurry of chances, they take the lead.
They do. I mean, it's one of those goals where I've watched it lots of times now, but I'm sort of watching it once from the one angle, if you like. I mean, there's a few things in this. Like, Albert Sambi-Lokonga is quite high up the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot express to you how much I love Gabriel Martinelli, but looking at Gabriel Martinelli on this goal, maybe he's saving his energy. I think I'm being perhaps a little bit kind to say he's saving his energy. Doesn't really bust a gut to get back. And then I think Gabriel commits, obviously, to the tackle on Fernandez, which the referee plays the advantage on. Yeah. And then I think Zinchenko, this is sort of the yin and yang of Zinchenko, isn't it? Because a big part of why we played so well and why we were so dominant in that period where we were really on top is because of the role that he plays in this team and how good he is. I mean, some of his touches are amazing. I think he's just so secure in possession and so secure when the ball is coming to him that it gives us an element of control in midfield. But I do think as an out-and-out defender, there are, you know, you could say probably Kieran Tierney is a better defender than Zinchenko, but Zinchenko is a better all-around player and certainly someone who can tuck into that midfield role much better. And I think in this occasion, we maybe saw some of the defensive issues weakness might be the wrong word, but he got drawn to the ball. And then, of course, it was played outside to a man who looks like he was born to play for Manchester United. It's fair to say.
Yeah, yeah. Bruno Fernandes is sort of less appealing looking brother. this goal, when United had dangerous moments in the game in the first half, I did feel that Bruno and Rashford were both kind of picking up a bit of space in that area between our back four and our midfield. Mm. And perhaps that's not entirely surprising given that we've got two defensive midfielders out injured at the present point in time and spend deadline day trying to sign one. And Albert Samuel-Lukonga, I think, was caught. You know, he tried to close Eriksen down, got caught a bit high, and lo and behold, the ball went into that gap. I think from then on, a few things happened. I mean, Gabriel really commits. In the moment, I felt like he had to. On reflection, maybe he doesn't quite need to. I mean, I think basically 8 times out of 10, he makes the foul there and he takes a yellow card and you're applauding a piece of cynical but ultimately practical defending, pragmatic. But I guess, you know, he doesn't quite get the break of the ball. The referee, as much as it pains me, plays
that's a good advantage
and fair advantage. And I see Zinchenko's situation slightly differently there. I just think with Gabriel so out of position, I kind of feel like maybe he has to come across. But
yeah, maybe so. I'm looking at it again. I mean, what do you think of the goalkeeper? Is there anything he can really do there?
Yeah, slightly odd one because he
moves for his near post when I think the finish is very obviously going to go far post.
Yeah, which makes me think, did he give him the eyes? Because to everyone watching, you're thinking, that's going far post.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just his momentum that carries in that way or if he's deceived by like a look or a dummy. But yeah, I think he read that one wrong for sure. And I don't know if he gets there anyway, but it's... I think he'd probably look at that.
It's, you know, it's a solid finish from a guy who's, what, 10 yards from goal?
He's in his perfect position, Anthony, to finish that, unfortunately.
Yeah, so you can't put too much on a goalkeeper when he's beaten like that, when he's one-on-one. But it did look just a little bit strange.
Yeah.
Where do we go next? I mean, we got to halftime. It's 0-0. I think we had quite a good chance early on, didn't we? When was the Odegaard chance?
About 51 minutes, something like that. And it was two things back to back. It was a cutback which Odegaard sort of didn't make the right contact with.
Mm. And then there was a Saka shot just wide, wasn't there?
Exactly. Flashed it across the goal from the right-hand side. Which on another day, you know, might come off a defender and go into the net, but it doesn't. But then we do get our equaliser.
I mean, it's good work from... I mean, I said on the live blog, like, I could feel that there was a goal coming because, you know, there was a really lovely move, wasn't there? Do you remember the one where I think eventually Saka overlapped on the right hand? No, on the left. He'd come over to the left and he put in a cross which bounced on the top of the crossbar. But Arsenal worked the ball out from the back. And it was a beautiful piece of play. Lovely football, you know, to see us play that way and with that kind of confidence. This is where, you know, it's quite difficult to sort of gather my thoughts at this point because I like a lot of what we did. But obviously, when you're on the end of a 3-1 defeat, the result sort of overshadows how you think about everything else. But I do think some of the football that we played was really, really good.
It's a nice pass from... Odegaard off his right foot, actually, in the build-up to this goal, which gives, I think it's Varane, a problem.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus gave Varane and Martinez problems all day long.
Yeah, like he was excellent, particularly in the first hour.
Yeah.
thought he was the best player on the pitch, really. And, you know, it's so interesting. We've had this conversation before about physicality and do Arsenal need a tall forward? And, you know, admittedly, he was up against Lisandro Martinez in one of those centre-halves today, so not the tallest. But physically, he really gave them a tough time. And Varane too, you know, the backing in, the ability to receive the ball. There was one, I think, Rouser kicked about 60 yards and he just sort of killed it.
Yeah, dead. On his thigh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, with a defender on him as well. It's a great outlet for us. And another, you know, I know he's kind of flavour of the month at the moment, but it was another good performance from him.
Yeah.
And I thought Martinelli as well. I mean, those two in tandem are a nightmare to defend. You would not want to be up against them.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't.
They are relentless.
So the second United goal.
Yeah.
I think there was like a moment in this where, like, I like the intricate stuff that we play. I like when we're creative. I just think there was like a moment when Zinchenko did a little kind of backflick to Lokonga, which he got away with, but it just didn't, just, I don't know what it was. I was going, oh, don't do that. And then Sambi gave the ball away.
Yeah, he sort of takes it out to his left foot, doesn't he? And he's not comfortable there. And actually, the position we lose the ball in really affects the structure of the team, because suddenly you've got Sambi almost in the left-back spot, Zinchenko trying to cover the centre of the midfield, and United just play straight through the middle.
I mean, it pains me with all of my heart to say this, but it's a very good pass by Fernandez.
Very upsetting.
It's horrendous.
I think they got quite lucky with the finish as well. Seen a good, it's hard to tell because it takes the deflection so early, but I think he might have been screwing that wide. But
right, I can look at it again because I've just downloaded the game, so I can look at it from all the angles while we're talking. But I just wonder if you know, in that kind of circumstance, remember we talked a bit earlier about like the team being a little bit inexperienced. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder about Saliba's positioning in that one.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to have a look at the angles here.
Yeah, he gets run across diagonally, doesn't he?
And maybe he should just drop off a little. It's hard. It's impossible to know because he takes the shot and it hits, is it Ben White?
It's very early, yeah.
Yeah, he takes it very early, so it's just impossible to know where that was going. I think Ben White was really unlucky for both of the goals, to be honest. He really was. On another day, he's making an
incredible block. Yeah.
Yeah, he's making two fantastic blocks because he was the one who got back in for the second goal, almost got back in and made the block for the second goal. And, you know, it's last-ditch defending when you're the last guy. It's tough going, but he really did well to get back in there. I think he was quite unlucky, but we paid the price for a sloppiness high up the pitch and then just a little bit of inexperience at the back. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think, by the way, just to say, like, the threat from United was always in behind, right? Like, it was always those pacey front men running in behind our high line. And I think we could have been a bit, as you say, smarter about that.
Yeah. So, look, it's 2-1. And I think one of the things maybe that plays into the decision that Mikel Arteta makes with his substitutions is the fact that Odegaard was, you know, carrying a knock mm-hmm. after the Villa games. Zinchenko hadn't trained. On the Friday anyway, when he had his press conference, he said Zinchenko hadn't trained. Maybe he's just talking bullshit and he had trained and he was just spoofing, you know, for the sake of whatever, a little bit of team news or team marginal gain he might get there. But two guys who have been injured, so maybe that played a part in the decision-making, you know, when they were coming off the pitch. But I'm just going to get the quotes here from Mikel Arteta, if I can. And let's have a look here. He was asked on Sky about the triple substitution. He said, did the triple sub make the team more open? He said, I don't think so. The way we were playing, we have the same numbers in the back line against the players they had. Maybe different profiles, but I don't think that was the case. And I kind of disagree. Because I think it changed the shape of the team. I think that change of shape is what United took advantage for their third goal.
Yeah, I'm trying to work out exactly how we were set up, excuse me, after the changes, because we went to the system that we used, I think, against Fulham, right, which was sort of Martin, Jesus and Nketiah up top, Martinelli and Saka as wing-backs.
Mm.
And then I guess it was kind of Shaka, Shaka, Vieira, and Smith Rowe through the middle.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, when we did that against Fulham, we had Shaka and Elneny still on the pitch at kind of the base of that midfield, which gave, I think, the wing backs and the creative players and the strikers more license and gave the team more structure.
Mm.
I think going with just Shaka, not leaving one of Sambi or Zinchenko in next to him, was probably too cavalier against an opposition who carry this much threat.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at it again, and I think what it is there's a piece missing in midfield, and it's probably where your six should be, right? I mean, Eriksen makes the run. I've done the pausing thing. It didn't look offside to me. Ben White almost
our offside line. I think Ben White just gets it wrong, basically.
I think that's a little bit harsh on him, just a little bit, because maybe he should. Maybe he does.
Because Saliba's playing high, right?
Yeah.
He's like on the halfway line.
I don't know why he's quite that far forward, though.
I agree with that. That's slightly odd, but I think if you're in that back three with him, you probably need to follow him. I don't know.
Yeah, he's actually, it's just, I think we got a little bit ragged, you know? We didn't quite find, I think you could make a case for each of those substitutions on their own, you know? Like we said about the players who've been injured and everything else, but I think it left us just a little bit scrambled for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And United took full advantage of that, and it was a very annoying goal to concede.
It was a very annoying goal, and I think, I mean, Ben White, he really nearly gets it.
He does. He does.
And three goals, I think, really flattered them.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, look, I saw Roy Keane was on TV afterwards and he's going, who cares about performance? It's all about winning football matches. And it's like, yeah, okay, it is. We all know that. But like, you have to be able to analyze a game beyond the scoreline. You know, you have to be able to say, I'm sure even Manchester United will say, okay, well, that was maybe not our best performance, but we did this, this, and this. It worked. We did this, this, and this. It didn't work. And from an Arsenal perspective, you've got to be able to look at a lot of what we did, or, you know, at least a good chunk of what we did, and feel encouraged by the way that we played. You know, this was away at Old Trafford. And, you know, you can say, okay, we got sucker punched again. This is what always happens to us. And maybe that's true. But you have to be able to try and objectively analyze both sides of a performance. It's really difficult, isn't it, sitting here after a 3-1 defeat to try and think about the things that we did well, the things that were good about the way we played. But, you know, for me, it was just more of a continuation of what we've seen for the most part of this season, that this is a team that looks pretty solid, pretty confident, assured of its decision-making. Like, they didn't look overawed or worried about going behind. They got a goal back. And I think from there, I think you can start talking about the experience or inexperience. And I think that applies still to a certain extent to the manager as well. That there are things that he does sometimes that, you know, in hindsight, he probably wishes he hadn't. And the three subs, I think he might reflect on that and think, that probably wasn't wise. You know, he could have done two, then another one a little while later. So you're not moving so many parts around. And when you are playing a team that is good on the counterattack, maybe that's what you have to think about.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we scored that Martinelli goal and they ended up scoring three goals against us that were pretty similar.
Yeah, yeah.
And had we got that first goal, it would have changed the pattern of the game, would have made it a very different affair. But I still think you look at those raw numbers and, you know, 61% possession, 16 shots away at Old Trafford. Yes, we didn't always convert that into really threatening chances, but I think Arsenal have played six league games and they've been the better side in six league games. And I think Roy Keane can say it's about results. And I think, of course, he's correct in one respect, but you have to hope that your performances, if you perform well in the longer term, that's going to be what's truly beneficial. And
sure,
United have won, I think, four on the spin. Fair play. But I think even a United fan would tell you they've not been great in any of those games.
It was amazing to me that, like, you know, on Sky, it was like they lost the first two games and it was barely conceivable that they could win four in a row. And it's like, what? This is, at the end of the day, Manchester United.
So they keep saying,
you know,
I think they
were bad in their first game, but I think the Brentford game was just a bit of a freaky game, you know, like Brentford will play Manchester United, I don't know how many times, and they will never beat them 4-0 again.
We've all had a freaky away game at Brentford. We've got one in a couple of weeks' time, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, where were we on this?
I don't know. I mean, you know, when I tweeted, after the game, and I said something to the effect, and I'll say what I actually said because I think then it'll, you know, I'll get it right. I said, it's always painful to lose to United, and those were poor goals to concede. Don't get me wrong, every point matters, but I think most people watching would conclude that Arsenal looked a better team, and you have to hope that over the course of the season that pays dividends. And I actually had, like, quite a lot of United fans in my replies making a point of coming on to say, as a United fan, I felt like you battered us in that game, which, you know, we don't care what they think, but it's sort of indicative. You know, I think a lot of people who were watching this match thinking Arsenal aren't really up to much. They haven't played anybody. Mm. Bizarrely enough, I'd include Gary Neville in that from his commentary on Sky, came away from the game with a better impression of Arsenal than they had going in some ways.
Yeah.
I know that won't be much comfort because it's the wins and the points we really want. But
sure.
I don't think it's a case of back to the drawing board. I do think there are some areas of concern. And one thing that I really think is, you know, on the horizon, just a few games away, Arsenal have a Premier League game against Spurs, in the North London Derby. And the way United played and the way they scored their goals in this game felt very Spursy. And I would urge Arsenal and Arteta to use this game to learn the lessons before that derby match.
I think that's a great point because I was thinking very much the same kind of thing, like playing pretty bang average football, but being super efficient on the break or, you know, with the good forwards that you have. And yeah, you know, we saw that last season as well where, you know, there is something to be said for we are going to go there, we're going to play our game, we're going to try and win. We're going to, you know, dominate possession. We're going to play in your half. And that's great. But you have to be super, super conscious that unless you're so solid, when the ball breaks down from time to time, as it always is going to do in a game, you're able to cope with what the opposition have from an attacking perspective. So,
especially against teams who have that quality. And, you know, we don't want to give United too much credit, but in those moments, they pick the right pass, they pick the right shot, they pick the right options. They were clinical with what they had, and Spurs, you know, will be the same.
Mm.
And if Arsenal are going to... I don't think Arsenal are going to change their philosophy. I don't think Mikel Arteta is ever going to go into these games and think, I don't want to dominate the ball. I don't want to take the game to the opposition. But you have to press home the advantage in those moments, and you have to convert that into goals. Otherwise, you end up proving people like Roy Keane right, and no one wants that.
Yeah. So look, Arsenal, and we've done the touches in the box thing. 16 shots to United's 10, but 3 on target to United's 6. Mm-hmm. Does this feed into perhaps what Mikel Arteta was saying a couple of weeks ago, where he talked about wanting more firepower. Do you think that those things are related, or it's not beyond the realms of possibility that the players we have on the pitch could do more in certain scenarios that we got ourselves into? I think sometimes we're a bit guilty of just waiting for the perfect opportunity. I don't want to do that whole Arsenal, they just try and walk it in kind of thing. But there are times where I feel like we could be just take a little more of a chance in the box. When it's open for you, even if it's on your wrong foot, take a shot. You know, those kind of moments. I know there's a thing about, like, you want to fashion the most, the best possible chance you can get. And I do think our XG was higher than United's. Maybe that's by virtue of the 16 shots as much as anything else. But, you know, there are moments where you think, just pull the trigger.
Yeah, because I've seen our finishing criticised, but honestly, I don't reflect on a great many of wasted shooting opportunity or chances that shots that were bad, if you see what I mean.
It's one pass too many, or like one flick too many, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah, I think there's something to that for sure. But it's also kind of a game state thing in that, you know, when Arsenal played in transition, the rare opportunities they had, I think they were very good. Again, you'd cite that Martinelli goal or some of the breaks Jesus made against the run of play. Mm. But when you are the ball-dominant team against a side who are flooding back, who've got eight or nine men behind the ball, you almost have to work that bit harder, find that extra pass. And, you know, we didn't quite manage that today. So it's frustrating. It's frustrating. Mm. But I would say not, for me anyway, not too disheartening.
I would feel a lot worse if we'd gone to Old Trafford and we just weren't in the game. You know, sure. If we'd been on the end of a 3-1 where we huffed and puffed and didn't really show very much and lost, I'd feel a lot worse. I mean, I feel bad enough as it is, but, you know, I do think there are things to be encouraged about. I think we've always said there are going to be games this season where things don't go your way. You're going to have setbacks. You're going to have to deal with adversity. You're going to deal with defeats. You're going to deal with decisions that don't go your way that perhaps change the complexion of a game. And I think this is one of those. Yeah. You know, I know it's still very, very early days, but as much as I hate losing to them, I feel slightly, what's the word? I mean, we're still top of the league. You know, it's a nice place to lose a game from, even if obviously I would prefer to have taken all 3 points. You know, United are the ones playing catch up. Other teams are the ones playing catch up this season. And, you know, I think we have to take the positives from what we did today, learn from the inexperienced moments, and I think there were some, and, you know, work on those on the training ground and try and put those right, because, you know, at the end of the day, it is still a young team. Sambi is very young in midfield, and maybe we'll have a question or two about him in part two. Saliba's still quite young as a central defender. You do make mistakes, you know, you do have to go through these moments to learn and to hone your game. So it's frustrating and it's annoying, and I think the scoreline really, really flatters Manchester United. I wish we'd been just a little bit more efficient in the final third, because I think that would have, you know, we would be sitting here talking about taking a point at the very least. But it's not like we were completely outplayed or anything like that. Far from it, you know?
No, absolutely. So, yeah, and listen, one thing we've seen from Arsenal this season is a capacity to bounce back within games. I mean, they did well to get back into the game and get the equaliser today. That's partly why I feel like they should have kept plugging away with what they were doing when they went to 2-1 instead of really rolling the dice at that point in time. But they've got a good opportunity next week, 2 games. It's the start of that experience for this squad, you know, having the European trips and away trip and then a Premier League game on the Sunday. It's going to be really important that they adjust to that, cope with that, handle it. And Everton at home next week is a fairly kind fixture to get you back on the Premier League horse, I think.
Sure. Sure, and one that we won convincingly last season. I know the dynamics of that game were very different. Season was over, Everton had just avoided relegation.
And you were there, so the boys really wanted to play up, you know.
They did it.
They were highly motivated. Well.
And I thank them for that. It was very kind of them. Anything else on this before we go into part two? I'm sure there are probably some other bits and pieces that will crop up in the questions.
I think that's it, really. I think, let's get to the questions, see how we do.
Oh, can I just make one point?
Oh, yeah.
Based on the commentary, and he do you remember the foul by Sambi on Bruno Fernandes?
Yes.
Where he sort of followed through, and there was a little bit of studs on the back of the calf or whatever, but I think it was more about momentum than anything else. And Gary Neville was like, that's nasty. And then they were talking about like some of the fouls in the Manchester United games before. And they were talking about remember the game when Gary and Phil Neville, fucking Tweedled Cunt and Tweedled Cunter, fucking ganged up on Jose Antonio Reyes.
Yeah.
And literally did that, but much more cynically and continuously throughout the game and never got fucking booked. It was obscene almost the way that they kicked him off the park that day. And he's going, with me, it was just a bit like mistiming. I never did any of that. I was like, fuck off. You rewriting history, little fucker. So that was the only other point I wanted to make.
No, I think that's absolutely fair. And to be honest, I did find it slightly galling and frustrating that, you know, when it's Man United, Liverpool, Old Trafford, they have Neville and Carragher in the commentary box together, and we have to have Gary Neville. You know, it's not as if Sky don't have someone like Alan Smith on their books who they could just bring in to provide some balance. So I found it very strange that they chose not to do that.
Yeah, I wish they'd bring in Patrick Vieira on co-commentary and see how.
Well, exactly.
See what he has to say for himself. Then, all right, let's take a little break here. We'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog. Also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. Let me allow you to go first this evening, James.
Okay, let's deal with this. So MNTN56 on Twitter. Yeah. Says, has this weekend been the beginning of the end for VAR? Their involvement today was as predictable as it was disappointing. And then Scrumpy Lungs on the Discord said, VAR this weekend. West Ham disallowed goal. Van Dijk should have been sent off. Newcastle disallowed goal. Leeds not getting a penalty. Villa disallowed goal. Brighton disallowed goal. Arsenal disallowed goal. Question, what the fuck do we do about this thing that is ruining the Premier League?
I don't know what we do. People will make the point, it is not the technology, it is the people using the technology. But I also think it's the implementation of the technology. Like I said in the first half, and I said this on Twitter as well, it really feels like they are trying as much as possible to find any way possible to disallow a goal. Like there was one today... The Brighton goal. Did you see that one that was disallowed?
Mm.
Ball came in. The guy was offside. He went for an overhead kick. Nobody appealed for offside. I don't think it really impacted the passage of play in any way. Guy whacks it into the top corner. Best strike he'll ever hit in his life. And they go back and they take 4.5 minutes. 4.5 minutes before they can come to the conclusion that A, this guy was offside when the ball was played, by how much we don't know. And that's that. The impact on the games is just awful because you feel like you can't celebrate a goal because there's going to be something that will chalk it off. And not only, you know that they're analyzing it too much. There's too much. It's too microscopic. Like, it is... having a negative impact on football. I mean, the decisions yesterday, whatever about ours today, where you could probably go either way on whether that's a foul or not, you know.
Yeah, the West Ham one is scandalous.
The West Ham one is absolutely ridiculous. To disallow a goal like that in a London derby at that stage of the game for nothing, like literally nothing, you know, it's no wonder people are asking questions about the people who are running the game or officiating the games. Because, you know, when you see something like that, you know, two thoughts go through your head. One is it's just pure ineptitude, and the other is that it is corruption of some sort. I don't want to go down that road, but it's easy to let yourself think that because you look at it and you go, well, how can anybody... who is working as a professional in the game of football, look at that and think it is sufficient to disallow a goal. So the other option comes straight into your head. I also think the Newcastle one was ridiculous as well.
Mm.
A foul on the goalkeeper, but it's only a foul on the goalkeeper because the Crystal Palace defender pushes Joe Willock into his own goalkeeper and actually gets what he deserves when the ball rebounds off him and... goes into the net because that can be a dangerous foul. When, you know, Willock was going up for the, was going to go up for the header or whatever it was. If you're pushing a player in the back, even a little nudge when he's running at high speed, and also when there's another goalkeeper, another player coming towards him, that could have been a fairly heavy collision. You know, you could be talking cracks of heads or smashed teeth or whatever it is. So I thought he got exactly what he deserved for that. And somehow they give that as a foul on the goalkeeper. It's bonkers. I just don't get it. I don't know what they're seeing that we are not seeing.
No, and I think you've nailed it. It does just feel like they're looking for reasons to disallow goals. And I say that knowing that, you know,
last week it didn't happen for us.
Yeah. And you know, if a goal was scored against us and there was a marginal foul in the build up, we'd probably be spitting blood, and the like. But, you know, that is football. That is football. And I think, personally, that is a price I'm prepared to pay, actually. Like, it is a price I'm prepared to pay, because I do think that this is so damaging to the spectacle of the game, especially for the fan in the ground, who may be a minority, but I think are increasingly treated with such contempt by the game.
Yeah. So are you talking about like doing away with VAR and just dealing with human error and refereeing mistakes?
The referee got the West Ham one right in real time.
Yeah.
He gave a go.
And the Brighton one today, that would have, nobody would have appealed. Nobody even appealed for an offside.
Nobody would have appealed. And shout out to Alexis McAllister, by the way, because he did get an absolute screamer in the 93rd minute, but he shouldn't have had to go and do that. I basically think that I understand the point people make. It's not the technology, it's the implementation. Those guys love, people who say that, I'm like, you love technology, but don't you know eventually the technology will turn against us and mount a rebellion? That's
have
how
you,
it works.
Have you not seen Terminator?
But I do think that if you ask yourself the fundamental question, like, are we still getting controversy? Are we still getting mistakes, even with the use of video? That I think the answer to that is definitively yes at this point in time. And I accept there are lots of times where VAR gets it right and we don't talk about it. But I just think that the cost in terms of the spectacle, for me personally, is too great. Like, I just don't see it as being worth the trade-off at this point in time.
Do you think the controversy is worse? Sure.
Well, yeah, because it's more egregious, right? Yeah. Like, I think actually, I know this is a point Tim Steelman's made in the past, but you know, if we accept that referees are going to make some errors in real time, you know, I do think there are 23 people on a football pitch, and we accept 23 human beings, and we accept sort of inconsistency or mistakes are a fact of 22 of those people.
Mm.
But it's, you know, it's only fair and reasonable to accept that in the 23rd. And I do think if we could sort of be a bit more, as a nation, as a football-loving public, grown up about that and realise that, you know, mistakes happen, but, you know, we're sort of, for the integrity of the spectacle, then it's not worth applying the technology. I personally think that would be my preference.
Sure.
But the genie's out of the bottle now.
Yeah. But do you not also think that the what we're seeing from the officials on VAR feeds into the distrust that people might have had at maybe a low level or a medium level about the standard of officiating in the Premier League and is now off the fucking charts?
Well, yeah, the more scrutiny you apply, the more maddening the decisions will be. And unfortunately, video technology and its place in the game and its place in the coverage of football is hugely amplifying all these conversations, because it's that much harder to get your head around them getting it wrong.
Mm.
And my personal opinion is that I would far rather the money that is being used on implementing this technology was used to raise the standard of on-field officials. That would be my preference. But I completely accept that for some people that seems like a very Luddite stance. And I also accept we're past that point now.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going back. But this was an interesting one on the Discord from the Baptist, who said, do you think the way the discussion around VAR is framed helps? He said, all the discussion at halftime was based around if Odegaard fouled Eriksen, but it should have been, did Paul Tierney make a clear and obvious error in not making a foul or not calling a foul initially?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the conversation should be, the great thing about football is goals. Like,
yeah,
the laws of the game should be, and in some cases have been designed to be advantageous to attackers and to facilitate those moments that make people love football and love the game.
Mm.
And it does just feel like we are chiseling away at that and making a game with fine margins even finer and reducing some of the joy. I mean, you know, one of the other problems football has with video is that football, it's not tennis where the ball's in or out. You know, it's got a set of laws that require to a certain extent interpretation, or certainly are open to interpretation. Mm. And so the pursuit of kind of objective right or wrong is always going to be problematic because there's too much grey. But even something like offside, which is seemingly black or white, personally, I just find even and I know we can go automated with offside, and that is what's going to happen, and that will probably be better than someone getting a ruler out in a studio in wherever it might be. But even that just seems completely absurd. I mean, if a guy is an inch in front of you, I don't really see how that sort of the spirit of the law or the spirit of the game. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not realistically, you haven't made a mistake. You're not in the wrong position if he's half an inch ahead of you.
Yeah, because you've moved your foot like a half a second before he has.
Yeah, I just feel like, what are we doing? what are we doing?
Yeah.
And I accept that there's so much money involved now and so much investment, and it is a low-scoring game. So these moments that are goals have huge weight. You know, hundreds of thousands of pounds rest on every goal. And so people want it to be absolute and they want it to be right. But it doesn't feel like we're getting any... We may be getting a bit closer on a purely statistical level. We might be getting more right. But sport is a spectacle, and I think we're taking away from it.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've had decisions go against us for time immemorial. That is kind of what happens in football, and I don't want to be one of those people who say it evens out over the course of the season, because I'm not sure that's true. I think big clubs tend to get more decisions than smaller clubs. Mm-hmm. That's the way it's always worked. There's a, I don't know whether it's a what kind of pressure it is, or if it's just a weight of things happening in a game where, you know, it tends to go that way. But I don't know, like the last couple of years with VAR, it really is soul destroying to watch a game of football and then sit there, wait around for a few minutes to see if there's some way they can disallow it or chalk it off. Like, surely even something like a time limit. I don't know if that would work. Does that just add to the entertainment? Does it make it more exact? But at least if it's just 60 seconds, like if it takes you 4.5 minutes to decide something,
then
it's
you don't
not,
know. Yeah,
you
exactly.
don't know. It's like the, what was the goal last season for? Was it Gabriel Martinelli against Brighton?
They
didn't know. It took them ages. There was no way they could possibly have seen it.
And unfortunately, the way that they are thinking about it is, well, better safe than sorry.
Yeah.
Better not a goal than a goal.
And it should maybe be the other way around.
I 100% think it should be the other way around. And I bet those away fans, when Bukayo Saka put the ball in the net, their first looks were to the linesman, to the referee,
yeah,
and not to the bloke next to them jumping up and down. And I think that's tragic.
Tragic is a great word. Because it is, you know, and it's, you know, it is the best thing about football, is a goal going in. Whenever it goes in, whether it's the first minute or the 90th minute, whatever it is, you know, this is what they work on. This is what teams do all week long, is they figure out ways to try and fucking stick the ball in the back of the opposition net. And it's really difficult. It's really difficult. A lot of the time it's really difficult, unless you're playing Bournemouth or something, right?
Yeah.
But it's tough. You know, to, I don't know, what must it be like now as a player to score a goal? And then, I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you get lost in the moment? You see them, they still do, I think. You know, they get lost in the moment and then it's like, oh, here we go. But then there'll come a time where players will score and they just won't celebrate.
Well, that's a horrible thought to have. I mean, I think... I just think goals are the reason we love games, and you know, they are. You wait 90 minutes for one sometimes, and then I accept that if one goes against you and it's a big goal and you feel it shouldn't have stood, that's going to be painful. But I can just say, imagine that's offset by stop having this thing of the rug ripped from under your feet and goals that you score taken away from you. Listen, maybe it's because I support quite a good team who in general score more goals than they can see, but that's a bargain I'd gladly make. And I do wonder as well if maybe the point about the coverage is interesting, you know, the way in which this is covered is becoming so dominated. I mean, how long have we spent talking about on the podcast as well? But it's just like it's become such a huge part of football discourse. And actually, like, although things going against you is kind of frustrating and annoying, it's also just part of being a football fan, right? Like, we're football fans, you know, I could find you a fan of every club who thinks there's a refereeing conspiracy against them.
Sure.
If you built a robot that made objective decisions and that refereed the game, people would be asking, well, where was the robot built? Was it in the Greater Manchester area? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's in our nature. But, like, I kind of think that's part of the football diaspora, and that's, you know, how that's always going to be there. And I think the more accepting we are of that, the less kind of problematic this all becomes. But yeah, basically, I've found this weekend's decisions and the coverage of them all pretty gloomy, to be honest.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. It really is. It's bad for the game. It's bad. You know, you made the point earlier. I know there's a worldwide audience. I know that the Premier League is a product and all that kind of stuff. But, like, why, you know, people are talking this season about, like, the atmosphere in Arsenal, for example. You know, that's what we know and that's what we're most aware of. Is like this sort of sensation, this feeling we have. Even if I haven't been to a game this season, I can feel it. I know what's going on. It's not just from talking to you. It's because I'm watching the games, I'm seeing the pictures, I'm hearing the songs, I can hear the crowd, I know the way they react to things, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And the idea that the fans inside the ground are like this secondary idea to the people who run the game, I mean, that's going to have an impact at some point too. And that's worrying also, I think.
Yeah.
Because,
I mean, in purely practical terms, do you think that there is a benefit to something like a challenge system where, you know, the video technology is only instigated when a team kind of plays their card, essentially?
Maybe so, because, you know, if you have a limited number of challenges in a game, I mean, you could use them all, of course, and you could end up with maybe many of the same decisions that we're seeing, but...
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the fundamental, isn't it? I mean, if you play the challenge card, but the decision...
Yeah, how many times are you going to concede 3 goals in a game? Not that often. So every time you concede, you're going to go, have a look at that.
Every goal would be challenged.
Every goal would be challenged. So I think, you know, that I like the idea of it, but I think it's imperfect. But ultimately, the genie is well and truly out of the bottle. The technology is established, even if we all think it's fucking chronic. And I think this is just something we're going to have to learn to live with, for better or worse. And
eventually, the technology will rise up and destroy us all.
Yeah. Robots, Terminators from Greater Manchester.
The robot referees from Greater Manchester are coming for us.
Let me ask you a question then. We'll get off this. Justaruse 16 on the Discord said, do you reckon Arteta has seen enough from Ben White to consider starting him in the number 6 spot? Lokonga hasn't been poor in his passing, but has been lacking that defensive prowess that Thomas Partey makes look effortless. We are creating enough chances through other channels, and it's not like Ben White can't pick out a decent ball and keep things ticking.
Interesting one. My instant thought is that when I think of what's required of our defensive midfielder, it's quite a specific thing. And I think of them receiving a ball from a centre-back or the goalkeeper with their back to goal and being able to either sweep that ball out to a full-back or turn into space. And I couldn't tell you, in all honesty, if Ben White can do that or not, because it's just such a different dynamic. It's like when you take an attacking midfielder and put him as a number 9, just the sort of body shape is so different that I couldn't say with certainty – oh yeah, he'll be great at that. So I'm not sure. What do you think of the Ben White, the new Colo Touré?
Well, I mean, this is it. This is the again, a story as old as time. A decent ball playing defender can easily be the DM that we've been missing the whole time.
He has done it a bit. That is the only difference. He's done it a bit at Leeds.
But he did it at Leeds under Marcelo Bielsa, who's, you know, you might ostensibly be starting in midfield, but you could be man-marking a guy who's going to be here, there, and everywhere. So you're pretty much everywhere as well. So
yeah.
I don't think it's quite as structured a role at Leeds as it would be at Arsenal. You know, maybe the wider issue, I don't really think that there's any way that Mikel Arteta will use Ben White in midfield unless there's an absolute complete crisis and we don't have anybody. Mm-hmm. I would be very surprised to see him move him.
I think the likes of Xhaka and Zinchenko would be higher on the list.
I think so too. But what about the broader point about Albert Zambi-Lokonga, who I thought on the ball today was pretty good, made some good switches of play, he was competitive again, but I think there is something to... people have said, you know, it took Thomas Partey a little while to figure out that role. And this is Thomas Partey, who's, you know, hugely experienced player, you know, worked with Diego Simeone at Atletico Madrid. It took him a while at Arsenal to get on top of that role. You remember last season, he rated himself 4 out of 10 because, you know, he...
Feels like a long time ago now, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
So he recognized that, you know, he had some issues in that role. So I think when we talk about Zambi, if there's criticism to be made of him in some of the positioning and the defensive aspect of that, I think that's fair, but it's not to say like, well, this guy's terrible and, you know, he can't ever be a decent player for Arsenal. It's just that I think he's been put into a role which is very, very specific and maybe requires a skill set and an experience which he doesn't quite have yet.
Yeah, I think in short, he's better on the ball than off it at the present point in time. And I think because Partey is quite good on the ball, I think sometimes we overlook what he does off it. And there have been games this season, I particularly think at Selhurst Park, where he wasn't very good on the ball, but made a number of important tackles or duels or picked up loose balls. I think he quietly does quite a fair bit of that. And I don't think Zambi's there yet in that respect. However, and you know, Arsenal tried to sign a Premier League player to come in and do that role in Partey's absence, because, make no mistake about it, I think Arsenal got a problem with Partey's fitness. You know, I found it telling that all Arteta's language was like, well, we hope it will be not too bad. We hope it will be 2 weeks. And how can you do more than that? Because this is a player who's had persistent injury problems. And I understand entirely why Arsenal went for someone in the market. At the same time, as they were doing it, I was kind of thinking, well, what does it say to Zambi? You know, if you really believe in Zambi and you think he can be that player one day, and then you get a couple of injuries in that position,
and the first thing you do is try and go out and buy someone.
Yeah, to a certain extent, you know, this is the time when you have to play that player, I think. So I'm intrigued to see how he gets on. I think he struggled defensively today at times, and I think he probably will as he learns and adapts and grows. And that's something we're going to have to accept because he's an inexperienced player. But I'm not prepared to sort of write him off and say he'll never be able to do it, because it's just too early for us to make that call.
Sure, I agree. And I think maybe what we're seeing is that the Partey situation is one that the club have to give very serious consideration to because of the persistent injuries that he's had. You saw the stat, I'm sure, from Mourinho, who's like he's only started 58% of games, Premier League games, since he arrived. So that means he's missed 42% of Premier League games since he arrived. And after a couple of seasons, you know, you could say, well, if it was one season, well, that was just a bit unlucky. But two seasons, and here we are into the third season, we've got another injury absence. So I do think it's one that they're going to have to think about fairly seriously going forward, because that particular midfield role in this team, in this setup, is really important.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Santi Cazorla situation a little bit, where Arsenal had a very uniquely talented player who kind of made that midfield really, really work. But he was also cursed with quite bad injury problems.
Mm.
And Partey's a different footballer in some ways. There are some similarities in the way they wriggle away from people. But again, it's a situation where, you know, he is vulnerable to injury. And I suppose if you wanted to be critical of the club, you would say, you know, that they seem to make an assessment and realise that Kieran Tierney's persistent injury issues necessitated a first-team calibre player coming in
to
kind of supplement him. And they don't quite seem to have arrived early enough at that conclusion for Partey.
Can I follow up on that? Do you mind? Because I've got a question right here. Let me see. It comes from, I had it right here and I know that it was on Twitter and now I can't find it. Oh, here it is. It's from James Gilheeny, who's at JJ Gilheeny, who said, two clean sheets in six, arguably our two best outright defenders on the bench. Time to change the back four?
I don't think it'll be talked about because he's flavour of the month, but I thought William Saliba had his most difficult game today in an Arsenal shirt.
I agree.
And in one of those games, he put a header past Ramsdale. But no, I think he's generally been very good, and I'm a massive fan of him, as you know. But I thought he had a tough game today. I thought he struggled a bit with the speed and the running in behind.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not something I would necessarily associate with him.
Yeah, usually. We had a question on the Discord actually about, like, do we worry about the pace of defenders? I don't know if I can find it here now. ATX Bergkamp Lover 69-69-420. Wonder what that guy's into. Anyway, he said, do you worry about the lack of pace with Saliba, Gabriel going forward and or that other teams might effectively use this match, the Manchester United match, as a blueprint?
Well, I worry about Spurs, as I said in part one.
Yeah.
But no, I don't worry about pace. I think Gabriel's pretty quick over the ground. I think Saliba's shown he is. There's a great incident last season where Mbappe's got about a 10-yard head start on him and he gets back and wins the ball. I think today it was more sort of positioning and his awareness of the runs off him. I think he was beaten by a couple of diagonal runs. But no, I'm not quite in a place of rip it up and start again. I think I've seen enough from that quartet to think that, you know, it's worth persisting with, especially, you know, you look at the games we've got coming up, Everton at home, for example, expect us to have quite a lot of the ball. I think these guys are really, really good on the ball. I mean, we had a similar question that I'll sort of throw back at you, which was from, who was it? Russian19 on Twitter, who said, was playing Zinchenko over ambitious? Tierney may have defended better, if not as good going forward.
I mean,
it's a hindsight one, I think, a bit. I mean,
a little bit. I mean, I do think that Zinchenko is more in line with what Arteta wants from a player at left back than Tierney.
Yeah.
I think Tierney's much more a bread and butter left back, if that makes sense.
And I have to say, as much as everyone's enjoying making fun of him for being quite short, I do think you can see now that Lisandro Martinez is a pretty good footballer. And again, would have fitted that mould at left back pretty well.
I agree. I never had any sort of doubt that he was a good player, but you know, the fact that we were going to play him at left back rather than centre half tells you probably what Mikel Arteta wants. And look, I think Tierney's a really good player, good character, glad to have him in the squad. He was one of those first name on the team sheet players for the last couple of years. But I think what Mikel Arteta wants from the player at left back is different from Kieran Tierney's main strengths. That said, I could see today where maybe you could make a case for Tierney being in the team as somebody who would give you greater defensive solidity. But then do you get that control? Do you get the control that we had for the best part of an hour without Zinchenko pulling the strings in the way that he does in midfield, and the way that it allows Granit Xhaka to and I think again Granit Xhaka had a good game today.
And I looked at United's right side early on, Antony and Dalot, and they've got quick feet and they're fast and a lot of trickery, and I thought, oh, Zinchenko might be in trouble here, but I don't think he looked massively stretched at points in the game. You know, we talked about the first goal. Did he make the right decision there? But I didn't think he was hugely tested. Mm. So I don't think it was a game where we needed Tierney, really, actually, as the pattern of the game turned out.
Yeah.
Would you change the back four or would you stick with it?
I mean, it's tough. It's a tough one because no decision is clear cut, really.
Yeah. And Tomiyasu hasn't really.
I think he's still finding his way
to be
back.
Dropped, has he?
Tomiyasu.
No.
But I mean, the question then is like, what do you change if you change one of the centre halves? Personally, I think if it were me, if I had to make a change, I think I would probably shift Saliba left and play Ben White with Saliba. I think Gabriel is maybe the one most at risk. And we've had this conversation before, and I say this, you know, where I said a couple of weeks or last week after the Fulham game where I thought he'd a very, very good game defensively. And obviously, apart from the mistake, but I thought was it the Fulham game? I can't remember, but there was one where he made a couple of really good defensive interventions. Could have been Bournemouth or...
I mean, he's a good player. But I'm with you. I'd be curious to see that partnership. For sure.
Yeah.
And I think we will at some point, inevitably.
It's a good problem to have, to sit here and figure out how you fit in these good players in your team rather than go like, well, I hope we never see him again, you know?
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see who plays centre-half in the week in the Europa League, you know? Obviously, you'd think Rob Holding, but...
I mean, do you think he might give Tomiyasu? Actually, there was a question, I think, on the Discord, so apologies for doing all these questions. But seeing as it's come up, let's see. It was about rotation. Bad Mr. Blonde said, how would you approach this Thursday? Maximum rotation to rest key players or minimal rotation to hopefully put the game away early and restore confidence?
Big rotation.
Maximum rotation for me as well.
And I think you might be right. I don't know if this is what you're going to say, but Tomiyasu at centre-half could be an option in the Europa League.
That's what I was thinking, to get the minutes
into. You've got Cedric, of course.
And you've got Rob Holding. Rob Holding play on the right, and Rob Holding can play on the left as well. But Tomiyasu plays left centre-half
for Japan.
So you could, you know, at right back, I know no one wants to think of Cedric there, but you know, in a Europa League game, I think if you're doing maximum rotation, you know, that makes sense, at least to keep him with some minutes under his belt, and then you get minutes into Tomiyasu in a position that's very natural to him alongside Rob Holding and I guess Kieran Tierney. Bigger question maybe might be what we do at midfield.
Yeah, I think that gets a bit trickier, and probably some players are going to have to play. Especially,
I
don't know if you saw David Ornstein's
I did.
Tweet suggesting that Emma Smith-Rowe may have picked up a problem. That's a real blow if that's the case, you know, because obviously the shifting the priorities to the central midfielder meant we didn't go and get a wide man, and he is, you know, ostensibly the rotation player, isn't he, in those wide positions.
Mm.
It's a good time to be Marquinhos. Let's put it like that.
It might also be a good time to be Fabio Vieira, about whom we had some questions as well. So Goon87, I'll let you do a couple of questions after this, I promise. Goon87 said, Fabio Vieira, a positive wrinkle to the match tonight. Pleased to see somebody so willing to shoot despite falling over the ball a couple of times. And is it Consrod? Consrod says, disappointing result, but any thoughts on Vieira's cameo? Thought he looked sharp and at least ready for a start against Zurich.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. I thought he looked good. A couple of rusty moments, but there was one pass that was nearly sensational.
Mm.
I think he's a really good footballer. When he signed I did the Y Scout thing.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, because I hadn't seen him play.
For people who don't know, Y Scout is a it's like a database of footballers, but you can then pull up clips of them doing like
like Pornhub for footballers.
Yeah, but you can do the, you can do like left-footed passes, whatever it is, assists. You can break it down, see the goals, see all the clips and the highlights of them. So that's a way of like saying, you know, or seeing what a player is like in the nude. I believe is it? It's in the nude. Is that what you're saying?
It's often in the nude. Yeah, yeah. I thought he was good, and I think. Hey, if you were depressed by us failing to sign someone on deadline day, you can just pretend we signed Fabio Vieira on deadline day and feel better about everything. I do think that his signing has been a bit overlooked. I've said that before, basically because we've not really seen him and we don't really know what we've got there. But I think he's got a ton of talent and I think he's going to be a really exciting player. So, yeah, looking forward to see what he does. And he looked up for it when he came on and he had a couple of good moments. So that would be really a boost, especially if Smith Rowe's got a problem, if he can start contributing.
Yeah, for sure. There was one brilliant pass from Martinelli. Yeah. Do you remember that one where he just
crossed the pitch,
curled it into the penalty box and it was like so close to being perfection. It was really, really good vision. And like Goon 87 said, he did have a couple of shots, put one over the bar, he got one on target, not really a difficult save for David De Gea, but got himself about. And like you, I think he is one of those players who, you know, perhaps people haven't thought about too much. It was good to see him, you know, as much as I didn't really think the triple sub was a great idea, you know, to see him on the sideline and come on was good, because I think this is a player who can really contribute to this team.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I know you said you were going to give me some questions, but we've sort of covered all the questions broadly that I had. I had ones about Vieira, Zinchenko. I've got one about Saka, but we're getting that every week. Do you want it?
Go on.
Sam J. Crawley, I may be in a minority, but I feel like Saka hasn't really hit the ground running this season, at least to his heights of last season. And then he says, who would be your in-squad alternative to give him a rest or kick up the arse? I mean, it kind of has to be Fabio Vieira.
Well, I mean, I guess it would be Fabio Vieira. But also, I think Bukayo Saka has got, you know, in six games, what's he got, like 3 assists and a goal? I agree, he's not played at his best, for sure. I think we can still see a lot more from him, but it's 2 goals and an assist, and he won he brought about the second goal against Crystal Palace, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know, it's not really a goal contribution.
Today, of course, for Martinelli.
Yeah, should have been an assist for Martinelli. Should have had a penalty last week. You know, I think some of his running is really good. So
hit the bar today, flash one across goal. I agree he's not at his best, but he's still
very good. Very good. Do you think we'll get the morale boosting after, you know, our unbeaten run was brought to an end? Do you think we'll get the morale-boosting Saka contract announcement this week?
Maybe. It sounds close, doesn't it?
Because he was talking about it. He was talking about Mikel Arteta and
he seems
good
very
it is
confident.
To work with him. And
everyone's very confident. So it's probably a matter of time. Maybe it will take... Maybe they'll wait for the international break or something like that. But yeah, that will be a big boost when it comes, even if he's not on top of his game, like others have said. I just think when he's really flying, things are just very fluid and automatic for him, and they're just not quite there. But I thought he had the better of... Is it Malacia, the left-back for United?
Yeah, I think so too.
I really thought he had the better of him. Maybe could have made more of that.
Yeah. But look, there you go. I think that's probably it for this evening. We should get this out for people to listen to.
Let's get it to the people.
Let's get it to the people. And, they can compartmentalize this result. Hopefully we go on to beat Zurich. We go on to beat Everton. Everything's back on track. We get the Saka contract announcement. All that. And
we're losing one Premier League game out of 38.
It's a disgrace. I'm only joking. Yeah, there you go. And actually, I've talked myself with you into a better mood than I was in when I came upstairs.
Well, there you go.
So thank you very much for that. It's good, isn't it? It's kind of cathartic. I know people say sometimes, you know, listening to the podcast after a bad result is cathartic, but sometimes for us, doing the podcast is cathartic. I don't know if you feel that way tonight, but I certainly do. I don't know if it was you, the conversation.
I think it might have been the drinks.
Or the Bombay Sapphire. I'm not quite sure. No, it was
you'd
you.
Have to take the credit. It was I don't you. Know if
it's,
I can.
It's all you. You got the assist on this one, James. Thank you.
Oh, great. Great, great, great. I'm not on top of my game, but I'm still racking up the assist, so that's fine.
New contract for you coming next week, by the way, as well.
All right. That'll be morale boosting for everyone.
All right. Thank you, folks. Have a great weekend, or what's left of it anyway. Thanks for being here, as always. We'll do some stuff midweek, of course. There's Europa League action, and then there is another game next Sunday, so we'll be on top of all of that. For now, though, have a good one. Remember, Gary Neville is a twat, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.